Hello and welcome to episode 117 of Speak Beastie for July 26, 2020.
I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
And I'm Shannon. We're back.
Yay.
We're back. Well, we've been back. But oh, yeah. Now we're back, which is, you know, the more important part.
I think it's been a while since I've been on.
Amy, weren't you on the last time I was on?
Was I?
Maybe you weren't. I know, Shannon, I'm pretty sure you were.
Yeah, I was. I've been on a lot of the most recent episodes.
Okay, Amy, you know, it has been a minute since you've been on.
Yeah. I mean, I talked about Hamilton for like 2 hours for our Patreon, but, you know, talking about Beasts, you know, that's
a
new,
talk about
new thing.
For 2 hours.
Well, let's jump right into the Phoenix Register.
Oh, boy.
And now a message from our sponsors. Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt Scamander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs knees and how.
So exciting news for our patrons on Patreon. Starting in August, all Thunderbird level patrons will receive a surprise reward delivered straight to their door. I love this. It's like such a sales pitch. a fantastic sticker. And each month will feature a different, unique sticker. And they're really, really cute. I've seen some of them. So that's cool.
That's exciting.
Yes.
Who doesn't love stickers? And Claudia Kim and Dakota Fanning read chapter 15 for Harry Potter at Home. I'm still very confused about Dakota Fanning and why she's involved, but okay.
I mean, there's a lot of non-Harry Potter. Like, didn't David Beckham read a chapter or something?
Yeah. It's so weird. I don't understand. Whatever. but you're able to watch that reading on Wizarding World Digital, and you can listen to the audio on Spotify. The latest reading that they've completed is chapter 17, but Claudia's reading came out after our last episode, so I just wanted to make sure to give her a shout out.
Yeah!
Nice. All right, well, that's it for Phoenix Register.
Sure,
this is
going
to be a quick episode so far.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, what with everything still being in a pandemic, there's not a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
So, let's get some Owl Post. We've got a bit of Owl Post this week.
Oh, this is where we find the meat of the episode.
Yeah. All right, so first up, we've got some Owl Post from Melanie. Melanie says, since we're once again on the topic of Dumbledore growing visibly so much older in a short amount of time, anyone ever thought about that at the time he might have already had a couple swigs from Flamel's potion? For whatever experiments they did, and we still might see, could have something to do with the blood pact or credence. So when he then stops drinking it in the late 1930s, his actual age catches up with him, and there we go, much older looking Dumbledore. Any thoughts?
That makes sense, because by the time we see Dumbledore in Half-Blood Prince, he's supposed to be, what, like in his 50? No, wait, I know my math's going to be wrong, but it's like 1939 that we see him with young Tom Riddle, right?
Yeah. So like 10 years after this.
Yeah. So that makes sense, because there's really no conceivable way you can go from, you know, Jude Law to Richard Gambon in 10 years.
But isn't Flamel at this point still drinking the potion? And he looks super old.
That's true. I guess it doesn't stop your aging.
I guess I never actually thought that Dumbledore drank the potion, but that's not supported by anything. That's just me never thinking that. And yeah, it does feel like Flamel, it doesn't stop like the aging, but maybe it does because Flamel has been around for a long time and we don't know how often he's drinking, you know?
That's true.
True.
And I guess like physically, from what we can see, he's definitely an old dude, maybe like physically in his like 80s or 90s.
Yeah.
As opposed to if his physical body was like, I mean, his physical body is over 600 years old, but if it had aged that way, he would, like a stiff breeze would knock him over.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely looks very old, but.
Yeah.
Played by a young man. I mean, not a young man, but a younger man, which is interesting.
Yeah, they were kind of short on 600-year-old actors. They were all booked.
Good point. Oh, darn it. They always get the best gigs.
I know.
In such high demand.
So many of them. Yeah, but I think that's, you know, a valid thought that could be possible.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious if, like, you know, the potion will come up, if the Philosopher's Stone will be used in any way. Like, Melanie briefly mentions maybe it could be used with credence in some way. That would be interesting. I don't know if that'll happen. I have no, like, confidence either way, but...
You know, that kind of also makes me wonder, will they keep using Jude Law throughout all five movies? Yeah. Or would they switch to Gambon after 1939?
I think they'll stick with Jude Law.
I hope so. I mean, they already got rid of Colin Farrell.
Yeah,
I mean, you can just make him look a little bit older.
Sure, I'm down.
I mean, listen, they switched from, you know, Ewan McGregor to Alec Guinness. Alec Guinness.
That's true.
And that was supposed to be like 19 years. And I believe George Lucas's explanation for that was they age faster on a planet with two suns. So. Sure.
Well, if you think about it,
at all, but.
Dumbledore has also aged backwards since you went from Richard Harris to Michael Gambon.
I mean, yeah.
Oh, that's true.
So he's just all over the place.
Well, let's go on to our next little bit of Owlpost. These are just a couple short responses to our episode 116 podcast question, which was, how do you rationalize / recognize canon for yourself? So, don't have a good username said. I reconcile the canon issues by looking at anything beyond the seven books as fan fiction or expensive fan fiction. This would include all movies, companion books, Fantastic Beasts franchise, Cursed Child, and J.K. Rowling writing / tweets. And Real Fishy says, canon for me is the original seven books, and that's it. No Cursed Child, Fantastic Beasts, or Quidditch Through the Ages, no interviews, and the movies are their own separate canon.
Yeah, I definitely agree with the movies being their own separate canon. Mm-hmm. Like, visually, they're so distinct from what we get in the books that they really have their own language. And there's, I feel like you can't really, what's the word I'm looking for? You can't really marry them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't, yeah.
Yeah. I tend to kind of make different little compartments for each thing that I consider its own canon world. So the books, the movies, then Fantastic Beasts is its own little thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just think I can consume all of them and they're their own self-contained worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And then just consider other things, extra tidbits and kind of just add-ons, but not necessarily interfering with the stories that I already know.
Sure.
I would include the original Fantastic Beasts book and Quidditch Through the Ages in the canon with the seven books for me.
Yeah,
I'd agree with that because there's nothing in them that contradicts the canon.
Yeah,
as we see
and they were
books.
Written at the same time.
Yeah.
So they like match a little bit more. But yeah, I guess everything else is like stuff that, you know, J.K. Rowling has said and the like Pottermore writings is kind of supplemental, like, oh, like, that's cool, but it doesn't have to be part of canon if I don't like it.
Yeah, it's very, like, which is good. Take it or leave it.
And then, yeah, the movies is, like, they're separate canon. But I guess that's where Fantastic Beasts gets weird, like, the Fantastic Beasts movies, because it's, like, are they part of the movie canon? They don't necessarily even match the movie canon. Are they their own canon? I think at this point, it's kind of, like, they're their own canon, but more connected to the movies than the books.
Oh, way yeah. more. Like, they have the same very strong visual language yeah. with the initial movies.
Which makes sense.
Right. So the yeah. fact that, you know, they still don't work with the movie canon, even have prevent the book canon, like, that is makes it so frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to make a prequel.
True.
As George Lucas knows. Yeah. So that's it for Owlpost. Thanks Bye, for owls. Writing Thanks in, for everyone. Hanging. We love it when you write in, because then we get to hang out with the owls. So.
Okay. So then, now that the owls have taken their leave, we're going to head into our main discussion. This week, we are going to be discussing movie segment 8, which is 1 hour, 10 minutes, and 1 second to 1 hour and 20 minutes. If you're following along in your screenplay, then that's going to be scene 70 through scene 84.
Yeah.
Okay, so we start with scene 70. Which is the exterior Hogwarts Lake, Beau Truckle Island, 14 years previously, evening. And just to sum up real briefly what happens in the scene, it's the last half of the last scene they covered on last week's episode, where Newt and Leta are having a very intense moment over Beau Truckles.
I'm so excited that we get the flashbacks in our 10-minute yes. segment.
Yeah.
The flashbacks are so good. I love that Beau Truckle Island is a thing and that that's the name of it in the script, and I wish I was there and that it was real.
I know. It sounds like such a nice place to be. You can just hang out with some cool Beau Truckles, look at the lake.
Yeah. How'd they get out there?
Magic?
Okay. I mean, legit. They stole one of those first-year boats.
Yeah.
I'm into that.
Maybe even, I wonder if Newt put them there. Like, he was like, well, I have all these Beau Truckles, and there's this island in the middle of the lake.
That would be funny.
I gotta say, like, the casting for the little baby Newt and little baby Leta is so on point, especially little baby Newt. But little baby Leta is also just perfect. You can absolutely see her growing up into Zoe Kravitz.
Yeah.
And the connection between them is so intense.
They're so good. I love them.
Yeah. They're just very good actors, very good casting.
Mm-hmm. And just watching back this scene, I realized how much it reminds me of the flashbacks from Deathly Hallows Part 2 and Snape's memories.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. With Snape and Lily, there's two instances where we see them, like, by the tree within that flashback series. Mm-hmm. There's the one where, like, Snape comes out of the tree roots when Petunia is picking on Lily and, like, shows her that he has magic too. And then there's also the bit where they're laying on the grass by the water, by the tree. I don't know. I guess, like, both of these flashbacks in both of these film series kind of show the same thing of that, like, understanding and, like, belonging between two characters. Yeah. And I think that's really cool.
Do you think Snape ever went to Beau Truckle Island?
I don't know. If he did, it wasn't to interact with the Beau Truckles. He would have just sat there and been moody.
Yeah, he would have been like, man, everything sucks. All right, so then scene 71 is an interior of an empty Hogwarts classroom during the afternoon. In this scene, Leta is interrupted by her daydream by Dumbledore, who showed up. They had a pretty intense talk about siblings and memories and regret and stuff like that. I feel like there's a lot of intensity with Leta in this movie.
Yeah. Leta is intense the whole time.
She's so intense. I love her. And this just also, like, one of my very favorite lines happens right at the beginning of this scene where Leta says, was I so bad? And Dumbledore says, you were very clever. And Leta goes, I said bad, not stupid. Girl! permanent sass record.
She's like, I know I was clever.
The scene between Dumbledore and Leta, it reminds me a lot of that relationship between Dumbledore and Draco, too. Just like another Potter parallel. Sure. I noticed on this rewatch. It's very like Dumbledore wants to help. He's trying to extend understanding and see that there's, you know, good and bad inside people. They're struggling with it. But both Leta and Draco are just like, nah, like, I'm good. I want to be miserable. Go away.
Well, they're both like, you don't know what's actually happening. And Dumbledore's like, but I do, though.
Because I actually know literally exactly what's happening.
I'm paying attention. You're not subtle.
We get in like when they're talking about their siblings and Leta asks Dumbledore if he loved Ariana. Mm-hmm. And there's just this long, like, uncomfortably long pause. You almost have to expect Dumbledore like, well, no, bye.
Yeah. It's such an intense conversation.
And also, let me pull up the screenplay so I can give the full quote, because just the one line out of context doesn't really do much good.
Well, I'll just say while you're getting that, I just like, please. These two are such good actors. And just to have this scene, this very powerful scene with the two of them is very good. This might be one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Definitely my favorite scene that doesn't have, like, Newt, Jacob, Tina, Queenie in it.
Yes.
Mm, yeah.
Okay, here we go. Leta says, did you love her? Dumbledore says, not as well as I should have done. Oof. It's never too late to free yourself. Confession is a relief, I'm told. A great weight lifted. And the fact that he says confession is a relief, I'm told, it shows that so much about him that he's never confessed anything to anyone. He just keeps everything. He keeps that albatross right around his neck, and he doesn't share it with anybody.
He's like, hey, confession is a relief. If you want to, like, confess, you know, whatever to me, I'm not going to confess anything to you, but...
Oh, no. One-way street.
Yeah. Yeah. And he does carry all of that pain and guilt with him, like, for his entire life. Which, you know, he says, regret is my constant companion. Like,
And it really is like, you know, they're not in the same boat, but they both blame each other for their younger sibling's death. Like, certainly Dumbledore's whole situation was a little bit more his fault. But he did not mean to, you know, kill Ariana, and technically he doesn't even know if he did.
Right.
Now Leta was like, I hate this kid. But
but she was also a tiny baby herself. Yes,
she was like, much
you can't
younger
really hold
than
a 6-year-old responsible.
Yeah.
For what they're doing.
So, but yeah, it's too bad that they never actually sit down and really, you know, talk out their issues.
Okay, I'm just going to put this out there that I feel like since hashtag Leta lives, that we get another spinoff that's just Dumbledore and Leta wearing kicky wizarding clothes and solving crimes. And I guess Theseus can be there too.
And just he being
can be
there really, too, like. Oh my gosh, Dumbledore and Leta being like really intense, and then Theseus is the fun one.
Yes.
It's like, come on guys, let's watch it. He's the loot of the team, but like way less.
Yeah. Okay. I might write this fanfic. I know what I'm doing for Nano this year.
Yes. I'm so into it.
Well, moving on to scene 72, interior, Grindelwald's hideout, drawing room.
A scene we've talked about a lot on this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the teapot scene where the pushy teapot is trying to get Queenie to drink of its tea. I don't know why I phrase it like that. And... then Queenie meets Grindelwald, and then he tells her to go.
Yes.
And this scene where Queenie's like, oh, are you married? And Rosia is like, let's just say deeply committed.
Oh my god.
Like, she's the Bellatrix of the Acolytes. Like, she is hot for Grindelwald. She
she's
wants
also
to marry
just
him.
Hot.
I mean, yeah, she's also hot, and so she's hot for... There's many hots going on here.
Yeah. She's just way less, crazy.
I mean, I feel like she's also crazy, just in a different way. Like, I think I said previously, she's the one who says the quiet part loud, which is its own kind of crazy.
Now, does this mean there's a baby Grindelwald out there that we're going to know about?
I refuse. We're not going to have another sequel where we find out that Newt's actually afraid of marshmallows or something.
Although, you know what? If there was some sort of sequel with a baby Grindelwald, and that baby Grindelwald was played by Jamie Campbell Bauer.
Okay, that would be good.
I'm okay with that. Just because I'm okay with more Jamie Campbell Bauer.
Coming to Broadway in 2026.
Yeah.
Please. Heard it here first.
The only reason I don't want Broadway to reopen is I don't want this to happen.
Zing!
But yeah, I also noticed Queenie's like all excited about the thought that Rosier is married. She's like, oh my god, are you married? I want to be married. Tell me about marriage.
Queenie!
And then it's like, oh, you're not. I'm not either, so. But poor Queenie, basically.
And I can't tell if you're joking or you just... French.
She's so cute.
I feel like every scene I'm like, oh, that's such a good line.
Yeah.
And of course we have the pushy teapot that's trying to get her to drink, and it keeps bugging her until she actually breaks her cup, and then it's like, oh, okay, I guess I'm done here.
Yeah.
And like floats off by itself.
This is the first time that I like really realized, okay, she must have, you know, drank tea before and it's trying to refill her cup. Like, I knew that we had established that, but this is the first time where I was like, okay, yes. Tea.
I just think it's funny. We spent so much time talking about the freaking teapot. And then when Poppy was on the podcast, she was just like, yeah, it's just tea. Like,
listen, we can't be sure. Sinister. It is interesting,
though.
In the screenplay, it says that Rosier is trying to refill her teacup.
Yeah.
And then a floating teapot comes in, like, a minute later. But they just went, let's just have the floating teapot, which is a good choice.
I mean, that is a funnier visual.
Yeah.
So.
And it's nice to have Rosier just sitting there, like, she's also intense.
She is. Yeah. She's very intense.
But she's just intense by, like, the way she is. When Queenie gets up and points her wand at Grindelwald, I mean, I know that we all know she's a badass, but just this time I was like, take the shot, Queenie.
Right? He is right there. He is maybe unarmed.
She could have just taken him out. Maybe. She probably would have been killed afterwards, but...
The if onlys.
It would have been pretty cool.
I'm just imagining,
imagine Queenie kills Grindelwald in this moment, and then Rosier becomes the big bad villain.
Ooh. Oh.
Yes.
And the final duel is between her and Queenie.
Ooh, yeah, I'd pay $15 to see that.
Oh, man. That's another fanfiction AU for the list.
Yep. So what I was wondering is, like, when Grindelwald comes in and he starts talking to Queenie, he's making very specific references to their life situations, that knowing that they're far from home, that Teen is an Auror, that there's a bad romantic situation. I was wondering, like, was his team tracking them? It's been a minute since I've seen the whole movie. Like, is this something they go over later that I just forgot?
I always took it as his abilities as a seer. That he just kind of knows these things, so therefore he kind of knows how best to manipulate people.
Makes sense.
Because he specifically knows that to get Queenie on his side, he's got to mention this whole, you know, freedom to love whoever you want type thing.
That's fair. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because he smoked on his Target hookah until he was like, ah, yes, the blonde.
Yeah.
And then I thought at the end, when Grindelwald tells Queenie, you're an innocent, I would never see you harmed, go now. It's really sneaky and really manipulative.
So annoying.
Because now if anybody tries to tell Queenie, he's a monster, he's gonna wanna kill you, or he's gonna wanna kill Jacob, she's going to be like, well, he didn't eat my face, so I'm going to vote for the Tigers didn't eat people's faces party.
Yeah. I mean, basically. I do wonder if he said more to her, or if she asked more questions, or if she did just dip out at that moment.
Oh, that's a good point. We don't see her leave.
Yeah. Right. I guess I always kind of had the impression that they might have talked for a little bit longer, but I don't know. And it is like the next time we see her, she's looking at the symbol, which we'll get to it in a little bit. But
I mean, it's very well played on his end. I mean, he acts very calm and reasonable and just like, yeah, I'm not a threat to you. Like, I'm not pulling my weapon on you. You're pointing your wand at me, but like, I'm just like, whatever.
Yeah.
It's fine. We're chill.
Yeah. Well.
All right. So, scene 73. Interior Hogwarts, Room of Requirement, night. This is the scene where Dumbledore looks in the mirror of Erised, and we get the info dump regarding the Blood Pact. And the first thing I noticed during this scene was that for some reason, Dumbledore has one sleeve up and one sleeve down. And at first I was like, well, is it like a... Because, like, they cut themselves on their arms, and maybe he's, like, rolling it up because he's thinking about Grindelwald, but then you see they cut their hands, so I think maybe it's just a Luke that he's going
just,
for.
He's just messy.
It's just fashion.
Yeah.
And that the Mirror of Erised, I feel like, is pandering, but it's more fan service. But this, I feel, at least allows for an efficient info dump.
Yes.
Pandering.
Mm-hmm. I definitely don't watch this scene, you know, relative to other scenes, and feel like, the Mirror of Erised. Like, it makes sense, and it's a thing that's been discussed just in Harry Potter fandom before, that Dumbledore lies about what he sees in the Mirror of Erised.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been established that, you know, it's there at Hogwarts, he has access to it. So, it makes sense, it doesn't mess with canon, it's like, alright, you know, if we're gonna get into this stuff, if we're gonna go to Hogwarts, sure. Look in the Mirror of Erised. And yeah, it is a very efficient way to tell the audience about this stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, throughout the Potter series, you know, it's always been speculated about what Dumbledore actually sees. And then by the end, we all kind of knew exactly what he saw, even though it wasn't spelled out specifically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just kind of obvious, a conclusion that we all got to. So I think it makes sense to finally kind of show it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very literally a will you like the reflection you see type of moment of self-examination, which is really interesting.
And it, like, is a little bit odd to see, like, a memory play out in the Mirror of Erised.
Yeah.
But
okay, so what I thought about that's interesting you say that, because I always thought that he was seeing Grindelwald and that, like, the way things were between them was his desire to go back to that. But then when I was watching it this time, I realized we see the physical object of the Blood Pact necklace.
Mm.
So I was thinking maybe that's really his deepest desire, is to get that back in his possession and destroy it. Sort of like
how
Harry
both
wanted the stone type deal.
Yeah.
That's true. That's a really good point.
And Dumbledore does eventually get the Blood Pact, because Pastries brings it to him.
Yeah.
Good boy, Pastries.
Yeah, that's a good point. I could definitely see it a mix of both, where it's like, you know, part of him just wants to be back how he was with Grindelwald, but then part of him is like, I need to get that Blood Pact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The way the actual forming of the Blood Pact shot, and like the way there's like that deep focus on the entwining fingers, and you can hear them both kind of breathing heavily, it's uncomfortably intimate. Like, you almost feel like you should be averting your eyes.
Yeah. My roommate, who has never watched the whole movie, is like sitting on the couch next to me and looked up and was like, yeah, this is very sexual. And I'm like, I know.
Your roommate is correct. And the other thing I was wondering was, like, what spell is this? Is this the next step of an unbreakable vow? Is this the hella unbreakable vow?
Yeah. I don't know.
I think that Helene would call this unbreakable vow Maxima.
Yep.
She would.
Well, it's like, I've always kind of drawn a parallel with this, and then, like, what we then find out with Kama having done an unbreakable vow, and they'd mention, like, the scars on his hands. And it seemed like that was, like, those lines of dialogue in, like, what, the next scene, is like, hey, remember what you saw in the last scene? That's an unbreakable vow. We're telling you now by being like, Kama has scars on his hands from an unbreakable vow. But maybe that's just too clever writing. But that's,
I mean, I'd like to think that you know, that's what they were doing.
Yeah.
Because I like that a lot.
But yeah, I don't know, because obviously this is different than any unbreakable vow we've seen, even, you know, different from Kama's. As far as we know, Kama doesn't have a weird, like, blood pact thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's unbreakable vow, Maxima. That seems legit.
No, that tracks. Because, yeah. I mean, the other unbreakable vows that we've seen don't involve any sort of bodily fluid. This is the first one we've seen that involves that kind of exchange.
I mean, right. That's my thing with Kama, too, is it is like, okay, so his unbreakable vow involved cutting his hand, but I don't know. It's weird.
Super weird.
Yeah.
Teenagers and the things they do.
Oh my god.
Oh yeah, you know, I was always making hella unbreakable vows with my pals.
When we I know, right?
Sitting outside the Stonewall Jackson in the garage, just fooling around making unbreakable vows.
We'll never hurt each other unless this fragile necklace is broken. Probably not fragile. It's going to be a process. Or the beginning of the next movie is going to be like, I broke it. Great.
And, like, Dumbledore shows up and is, like, what hand is it that he messes up in Half-Blood Prince? It's left hand, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So his right hand is all, like, black and shriveled. And he's like, oh, yeah, I broke it. I just ate it.
Dumbledore has had a prosthetic hand this entire time.
Yeah, it turns out that he just has a hook for the rest of the movies, and it's never addressed as to why.
Yeah. And Harry never noticed, like, Dumbledore has a scar on his hand from an unbreakable vow.
Huh!
I mean, he wouldn't. Harry's stupid. We like him, but he's pretty.
So, scene 74 is an establishing shot of Paris, the Marjo, I'm so sorry, the Rue de Montmorency?
Mm-hmm.
In the afternoon? Where we see Flamel's house that he has a sign on his house, because that's what people do with their houses where they live, is they're like, hello, yes, I have a sign. Nicholas Flamel lives here.
And I looked this up. That symbol is actually the L, I can't say it. Oh, God.
Alchemical?
Yes. I'm just, like, looking at it. I'm like, it's a jumble of letters. I'm just going to say alchemy. It's the alchemy symbol for gold. Not hiding the fact that, hey, an alchemist and quote unquote, therefore immortal lives here.
I would not brag via a sign outside my house that I may have gold.
Exactly.
But okay, Nicholas.
You do you.
Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting, because when I first saw it, I was like, that looks like the Ollivander's logo.
Yeah.
Does he have a Wandmaker side hustle?
And, like, always wondered, like, what the symbol was on the card and stuff, and I just never really bothered to look it up. But I did last night.
That's pretty cool.
That is really cool.
It's a nice bit of trivia.
And that's according to sciencenotes.org. So it's a .org.
That sounds like a legit.
So therefore,
website.
There's
Wiki agrees with you.
Yeah, there's like a lot of different symbols that have been used for gold, and that's just one of them.
That tracks.
Neat.
Now we go inside the house.
Ooh, scene 75. Ooh. Interior, Flamel House, afternoon, and this is just again pretty much just a quiet scene. Tina is reading and hears the Zowu roaring from inside Newt's case. The screenplay describes Flamel's living room as a creepy medieval drawing room, but, like, it doesn't feel that way. It feels very large and airy and pretty well lit, so it's not, to me, it's not creepy at all. It's just kind of dark.
Yeah, I noticed the screenplay kind of had discrepancy with, like, the layout of the house, too.
Yeah.
Like, it mentions Tina and Jacob, like, going down a hall that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. I like this room better than a creepy medieval drawing room. Also, I feel like if I was like, I'm going to go to a safe house and I don't know who lives there, and I opened it up and it was a creepy medieval drawing room, I'd be like, let's go to a different safe house.
I'm going to go get a hotel.
But this one I can see walking in and being like, oh, this isn't too bad. It's just a cute little house.
It just looks old.
Yeah.
And a little dusty.
So according to this screenplay, the book that Tina is supposed to be reading is, in fact, The Predictions of Tycho Dedanus, as mentioned in both a previous scene with Dumbledore and earlier with Kama and Tina. And so it's supposedly just fallen out of Kama's pocket, and she picks it up and sees a prophecy that is underlined and is reading it. So we were robbed of further information about this prophecy. I don't know why they keep, like, obviously, this book is written into the screenplay, and they just were like, nah.
Yeah, there's, like, a lot of action in this scene that just ended up not translating to the movie. Like, some of it ended up getting moved to a later scene, kind of.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think we ever make the connection that Tina's actually reading the predictions of Tycho Dedanus.
No. Tycho gets overlooked a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
Megan must be outraged.
I know.
On behalf of her BF.
What disrespect towards Megan's boyfriend. Gosh.
Yeah. Honestly.
So then we head in to Newt's case, the Zowu enclosure, in the afternoon. And again, just a quick overview. Newt is kind of working with the Zowu, and it's playing with him, and he's rolling around in the undergrowth.
Yeah.
I feel cute. like this is, like, a weird, like, they cut back and forth a few times, but at one of the points when he's in the case with the Zowu, it shows him using wandless magic to release it from its chains.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, once again, Newt is definitely more powerful and a better wizard than people might think he is, which is really interesting. And, like, I kind of feel how McGonagall said Dumbledore was quote-unquote too noble to use certain spells, even though he has the power to. Newt is sort of the same, in that, like, he doesn't want to use his magic for conflict or fighting. He uses it for his creatures and healing and nurturing.
I noticed in the screenplay it actually doesn't even have him using magic. It just says that he removes the harness, but I like the choice to have him use magic. One, I think it was a decision on, you know, the filmmaker's part to be like, it's hard to have him, like, remove a harness from a CGI creature. But two, it is cool to, like, see him use wandless magic, and to see him use magic, you know, for this nice, good thing. That is what his focus is.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other time I feel like we see, at least the last time I can think of what we see Relatio being used, is once again in Deathly Hallows, when Hermione uses it to free the dragon in Gringotts. So it's nice that the times that we see the spell being used, it's to help an animal.
And it sounds like such a harsh spell.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, I'm going to get these chains off of you. And I like seeing him play with the Zowu.
Yeah.
It's just a big cat.
Also, like, just real quick, how quick did he need to get that enclosure set up for the Zowu? Because that is, like, straight up Wilds of China.
I know.
In his case all of a sudden.
Does he just have, like, a ton of possible environments that no beasts are in? Like, just in case. When I go to China, I mean, he does want to travel internationally. It's like one wish in life. So,
forever my favorite line in this movie.
Okay, so these next three scenes in the screenplay all kind of run together, so I'm just going to kind of name each of them and kind of give a quick overview of what happens in all three of them, because once again, the way they're set up in the screenplay versus the way they play out in the movie is very different. So scene 77 is back to the interior of the Flamel house. Scene 78 is back into Newt's case, and then scene 79 is back out into the Flamel house. And what happens is Jacob hollers for Newt, hey, Tina's up here all by herself, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, hey. Maybe you should come hang. And
I'm gonna look for food in the attic.
never-ending quest for food. First he wants pan au chocolat. Now he wants attic food.
Man, I want pan au chocolat.
I know, right? And then when Newt does come out of the case, he talks to Tina. Then they go check on Kama. Pull the parasite out of his eye. Super gross. And then Tina runs off. So that's those three scenes that, again, are supposed to be three separate scenes in the screenplay, but are really, I feel like it's just two scenes in the movie that we get, which is fine because this is a lot less jumping around.
It flows better in the movie than in the screenplay. Yeah. Oh, so I really like when Newt climbs out of the case and he's talking about the Zawu and he's like, she was born to run. She's just lacking in confidence. But he's just like staring at Tina Tina and you're like, she was born to run. She's just lacking in confidence.
Oh, so sweet.
Yeah. And she's like, okay.
She's like, neat.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm going to go. No, she's not going to go yet. She's like, can you please save this man?
And so I was wondering, like, Newt and Tina both act like it's common knowledge that unbreakable vows cause scars. Yeah. But I don't think that's common knowledge because I feel like Narcissa would have been like, ow, these golden robes left scars on my arms. I wasn't expecting that to happen. Or something would, there would have been some mention of that in Half-Blood Prince when we see that happening.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if that means, if it's because, you know, Kama, like, he was a kid when they did the Unbreakable Vow, so I wonder if it's because he wasn't totally consenting because he was a kid that caused the scars?
Or maybe he was, like, fighting it or something?
Maybe.
Or it is, like, more of a blood pact vow, and so maybe he does have a little blood pact thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe.
I also think it's probably just a tool to use in the visual format as opposed to Brooks. Just because, you know, we see the scars, they say he has the scars, they connect the dots and tell us what the scars are from. So it's just kind of a tool at that point.
Yeah. It's one of those things that, like, that their, like, conversation about it in the movie, in the context of this movie, like, makes sense. And it's a good way to explain, like, scars on hand equal unbreakable vow.
Right.
But it doesn't match with either of the other canons.
Yeah.
So... I don't know. Unbreakable Vow Maxima, I guess. That's it.
And, like, when Newt's like, oh, I have some tweezers, and Jacob goes, tweezers? Like, he can't believe that Newt has something like tweezers in this amazing case. And then Tina and Newt both define them the same way as, like, pointy, pinchy things. And Newt and Jacob's like, I know what tweezers are. Like, oh, it's so good. I love these idiots.
It's so funny. Oh, and when he's like, oh, you might want to look away, and Tina's like, I can handle it.
Nope, I can't. I hate eye stuff.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
So gross.
It's very gross.
But then, at the end, when Tina's getting ready to leave, and she's like, goodbye, Mrs. Commander!
Oh my god! And in the screenplay, it says, with a wobble in her voice, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's like... So on point.
They love each other.
I love how, like, third wheel Jacob is through this whole scene. And just the way, because he's just, like, hovering in the background, like, in between their two heads.
Yeah.
And it's, like, just his, like, arm that comes in with the tweezers. I love it.
Ah, calamari.
Yeah, that's so gross.
So gross.
And then she storms out of the house, and Jacob's like, what did you do?
You didn't mention salamanders, did you?
And it's like, no, I don't know. And Jacob's like, well, go after her.
He's such a romantic.
Jacob's like, when you saw earlier in the movie when Queenie stormed out and I went after her, well, that didn't go well, but you should do that.
But this time it'll work.
Yes.
Aww. I love them so much.
So that was scene 80 that we just described there. It's super weird, like I said, in the screenplay. So then scene 81.
Well, yeah, because that's where in the screenplay, it's also described as like a hallway.
And yeah, which is not. Like, this is all kind of happening in the drawing room area.
Yeah.
Which is also just like a foyer.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't look like a drawing room. So weird.
That's true. It doesn't. So maybe Flamel's actual drawing room is creepy and medieval, but his foyer is just, like, nice and well decorated.
They just never got past the doorway.
So, scene 81 is an exterior. We are out on the Rue des M once again. It is the end of day. And Newt and Tina talk real quick. Then they look up to see the black silk banners dropping over the city of Paris. And this is also where we find out Newt's opinion of aurors, which is careerist hypocrites and people whose answer to everything that they fear or misunderstand is kill it.
Oof.
Cops, am I right?
Yeah. Not to get too political, but.
Or I'll be devil's advocate and say humanity in general.
Valid. I mean,
just about covers it, right?
And to be fair, Newt's talking about animals.
Yeah. True. He's not talking about people.
Right.
But, I mean, he still, you know, has a good point. And Tina's just like, I'm an aurore. And he's like, yeah.
Yeah, but you've gone middle head.
You've got middle head.
I love this line.
If I understood what this expression meant, I would use it in everyday life. But it really doesn't make sense.
No, but Shannon. The middle head is the visionary.
Yeah.
I don't know what the other two heads are, but the middle head is the visionary. So clearly, when you make a collective decision, you've gone middle head.
Oh my god. Oh, Newt.
Right.
I love it. I just want to start saying this. Like, if people stop me and ask me to explain, or if they like pretend they understand what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And we like sometimes when someone makes you mad, you can just sneerly go, oh, you're such a left head.
But you know what? That's the good thing about, like, honestly, in real life, when people say expressions you don't know, most of the time you just kind of be like, mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Yeah, sure.
But Tina is Tina. And so she's like, all right, Lou, what does that mean? Who else says that? Okay, that's what I thought.
Bless his mom.
She's also like, kind of like, should I be insulted? It's like,
yeah, that moment she's like, excuse me?
And he's like, no, you're a visionary. Yeah. And then these big black banners.
Yeah, and
just drop on Paris.
I remember when we first saw this in theaters, I remember just leaning over to Chris and being like, can everyone see this?
Yes.
Because we see the girl next to him and she very obviously notices them, but we have no idea who she is. We don't know that she's a witch or a muggle or who she is. So the fact that she is seeing them literally means nothing to us.
Yeah. And the screenplay does specify that muggles can't see it, but it's not very clear. It's not even like other than kind of, you know, showing that the redheaded witch, it doesn't like, it could have just, like, cut two shots of muggles who were just walking past it.
Yeah.
And, okay, you don't know they're muggles, but you know, oh, they can't see it.
Yeah.
Like, it's wide shots, so you can kind of look and be like, all right, a lot of people are ignoring this, but that's if you're, like, paying attention to the people and not these giant black pieces of cloth descending on Paris.
But it's right. It's also still confusing to know whether or not this is Muggle Paris or the magical part.
Yeah.
Because we never get a clear idea of how big the magical part is.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, we don't know if Wizarding Paris is just, you know, a couple of blocks like Diagon Alley is, or is it a bigger part of town?
Yeah. Because at first when I was watching this part again, I was like, okay, so they must still be in the magical, like, on the magical streets. And then it cuts to, like, a really wide shot of Paris. And I was like, no, I don't think magical Paris is that
big. Paris.
So, plot twist, Paris is just populated by wizards.
That tracks.
But then Grindelwald wouldn't hate it. He'd be like, this is great.
I love Paris.
But yeah, it is very, like, it's just, like, it's a overly visual effect just for the movie, just to look cool.
Yeah, and it's a beautiful effect. Like, this is aesthetically a stunning scene.
But it
doesn't make sense.
It's just not very clear what exactly is happening. And I think part of that is, like, it could have been filmed better, it could have been shot better. But also part of that is, like, all right, you could have just not had it be these big black banners.
Yeah.
And done something more subtle. But okay.
And so, like, then we move on. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and just also just the way the message is, like, how do you understand just that picture of a raven? Like, I don't know, maybe write the words on there of where you're meeting if it's only wizards that are seeing it anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So then we move on to scene 82. We are in a wizarding cafe, which I refer to in the doc here as Magic Starbucks. And, like, but it's a... We only one guy is, like, getting up and reacting to the black silk, which makes it me think it's, like, a regular Starbucks that this guy just happens to be in. But if it's a Magic Starbucks, everyone ought to be like, what the heck is going on up there?
Yeah, and the screenplay even says that not all of the muggles, that there are muggles in this cafe that don't see it.
Yeah.
It's like, but you also say it's a wizarding cafe, so what is the truth?
Yeah, so if it's in Place Cachet, then... There shouldn't be any muggles in there.
So yeah. Are the muggles just seeing a regular Starbucks then as its like cover to like how it appears to them?
Yeah. Yep, they're just seeing an art deco Starbucks.
When did Starbucks begin?
It was definitely like the 60s or 70s, I think. I'm going to Google it right now.
Let's double check on this. I'm opening it. 1971.
Okay,
but
yeah,
that's so, Muggle Starbucks, so.
That's true. Magic Starbucks has been around for way longer than that.
Yeah.
And I mean, as we discovered before during a new case, the Melusine is the logo for Starbucks.
That's true.
And yes. The Melusine works at the French Ministry of Magic, apparently, Whoa. With her little Madigots. So
she started Starbucks.
She Conspiracy? Started it and founded it right there in Paris.
Wow, amazing.
Mystery solved. So then we get scene 83.
Yeah, we move out. It's just an exterior shot of Queenie walking down a street in Paris. And she walks up to the black silk and touches it. And there's a silhouette of a raven that is faint at first. But when she touches it, it glows a brighter white.
Yeah. And as established earlier in the flashbacks, a raven is the symbol of the Lestrange family.
And I was wondering, like, is it common knowledge? That's the case. I mean, Queenie's an American. If I was walking down the street and I saw some black silk and there was just like some random heraldry on there, I would definitely not be like, oh, that's for the Tudor family, Earl of Waterpark. Like, I wouldn't know.
How would you know where they're buried?
Yeah, like, how much of this is common knowledge that they're in Père Lachaise?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing where I'm like, did Grindelwald talk to her more? But
that would make it make sense.
That doesn't necessarily explain how all of the people who show up at the end know.
Yeah.
Unless an address popped up, but like it, you know, it cut away before that.
And the other thing I was wondering about this scene is that, you know, since we're talking about like movies and books being their own separate canon, does this cause confusion with any Ravenclaws? Because in the movies, the symbol for Ravenclaw is a raven, not an eagle. So are there like does a Ravenclaw go up and be like, oh, my D&D group is getting together in Père Lachaise tonight?
Oh my god. I mean, I guess it's in Paris, so French people wouldn't necessarily know Ravenclaw.
That's true.
So maybe for the French, it is more of like an association with the Lestrange family.
That's true, because the Lestrange family is French, aren't they? Like, they're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that, like, the specific, you know, this specific raven silhouette is the Lestrange family.
That's true. It is very symbol. Visually different from the Ravenclaw.
But it is still, like, people gotta do some research. it's like, only people who really know Grindelwald are gonna show up at this thing, because everyone else is gonna be like, okay, that was weird. I'm not gonna look into that to try to go to this place, because someone sent a bunch of black cloth over Paris.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a, maybe I don't go there to the raven, weird raven place.
Okay.
All right, and then scene 84, last scene, is back where Newt and Tina was. I have feelings about this, but we'll get to that in a minute. And... Newt and Tina realize that Grindelwald's calling his followers, and Tina's like, oh, he's already got credence, it's too late, and Newt's like, haha, no, it's not, I'm a hero. And so the screenplay says that Newt and Tina are at the Place de Furstenberg, which is where the Ministry of Magic is in Paris. That's a half an hour walk.
Yeah, no, they're definitely standing in the same place that they were.
Yeah.
So once again, the screenplay just has these inconsistent, weird details that didn't make it to the screen, which is probably a good thing, because, you know, we're watching and they're outside of Flamel's house, and then all of a sudden they're halfway across Paris.
Yeah, that would have been weird. Yeah.
Not much else to say other than that's weird.
That's weird.
That's the theme of this episode.
I mean, technically our 10 minutes like cuts off in the middle of this scene. Long scene to begin with, but
there, like, I actually kept watching because I forgot that I was supposed to stop, and I was like, oh, this is really good,
right? I know this is the part where stuff starts like happening, and so you're I just want to keep watching. I mean, you can keep watching,
but yeah, and then literally nothing's stopping you. It's not like Megan's gonna like reach out from your computer and slap your hand.
So yeah, that's our movie breakdown of 1 hour to 1 hour 10 minutes.
Yeah,
to 1 hour 20 minutes.
Yeah, once again, it's a really solid 10 minutes. Like, I feel like every time I'm on and I'm reviewing 10 minutes, I'm like, wow, this is a really good 10 minutes. And then when I watch the movie as a whole, I'm like, this movie's a mess.
Why does that happen? This group of scenes, there's a lot of scenes in here.
Yeah, there's a lot going on here.
All quite short, but it's like the way they fit together works quite well.
Yes.
The way they fit in the movie as a whole doesn't necessarily.
No.
This movie is just so packed full of stuff that, like, any 10 minutes can be a good 10 minutes. But, like, yeah, like you said, watching it as a whole, a lot of it gets lost in the jumble. So it's kind of nice to watch it in 10-minute segments because it kind of gives you that space to let it sink in instead of just going by like boom, 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 and you miss things.
Definitely.
Yeah, I've said before that the first time I watched it with the screenplay, I liked it a whole lot more than when I just watched it by itself. And I feel like breaking it down and then watching it with the screenplay for just the 10 minutes is really, it's helping me appreciate it more and more.
Yeah. I feel like this rewatch, since we've been doing the 10-minute increments, I feel like it's the first time I've really actually noticed all the Tycho Dedonis stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And just, like, all sorts of things that just kind of went over my head every other time I watched it.
And that does come to, like, okay, if it's better to watch it in 10-minute increments, then it's not a very well-executed film.
It's a shame because, like I said, it's like such good scenes and good dialogue and great acting. It's just,
it's like a beautiful film. Just aesthetically, I think it's the most pleasing Harry Potter or Harry Potter related film.
Yeah.
It's almost like it needed those moments of like nothing happening to like just allow it room to breathe, and it just never got that.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about the first movie, it's like you get a few breaks, like you get like Newt and Jacob going to Tina and Queenie's house and eating and, you know, drinking cocoa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, those aren't like super plot important scenes. They're like good character scenes, but it's like, they're also just giving you, the audience, a chance to process what has happened so far in the movie. It's like act breaks. I mean, every movie you can split into acts. But yeah, Crimes of Grindelwald doesn't really have moments like that.
Yeah. So that wraps up this discussion of our deep dive into Crimes of Grindelwald. And our podcast question for this episode is coming at you in two parts. So part one, do you think that Grindelwald and Dumbledore's pact is an unbreakable vow? And question part two, why do we think some unbreakable vows leave scars while others don't? We'd love to hear from you, so drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And also, while you're at it and you're on the internet, please leave us a review on iTunes. It really helps us out to get more visibility, and we just really like to know what you guys think about the podcast, as we're always trying to improve, so we really appreciate feedback. And you can contact us by visiting any of our social media accounts. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SpeakBeastie, on Facebook at facebook.com/SpeakBeastie, on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com, and you can also support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/SpeakBeastie. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, our Thunderbird patrons are going to be getting some really cool stickers in the mail every month. So,
and during, while most of us are, you know, still in lockdown, Amy, I know you're working, and Shannon, I don't know if you're back to work yet, but while the rest of us are on lockdown, we've been getting a lot of good Patreon content out there. Like, I know Shannon just posted a really great fitness video.
Yes.
And I posted a video where my husband and I took on our version of, well, not our version, it's from a YouTube channel called How to Drink, our version of a low blaster, which was super fun to make and even more fun to drink. So there's a lot of good stuff happening on our Patreon. So if you have, if you're able to, $1 dragon a month.
Yeah, and listen, we don't judge people who just give like $1 and watch everything and then stop giving, because that's still $1. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we'll judge you a tiny bit, but like not a lot. Because then you won't get a lot of stickers.
Well, if you donate $1, you won't get any stickers.
Any stickers, yeah.
$5 level. But if you donate $5, get one sticker, we still won't judge you.
Yeah. It's a judgment-free zone.
Yeah.
Most of the time.
I'm Amy.
I'm Anne.
I'm Shannon.
Case closed.